looked at is the reference that Tzaddik knows the soul of his animal, he knows what his animal needs. But the Rasha, even when he tries to be merciful, is ultimately cruel. So the way the Gaon explains, the animal is the mashal for the human body and the physical needs of a person. And the tzaddik looks at the guf not as his real person. His real person is the neshama, but the guf is the beast of burden that is necessary for the neshama to carry out its functions. And the lesson is an important lesson, that the tzaddik is conscientious regarding the treatment of his animals, both his external animals and the animal which is the human body. He does not neglect it. But the Rasha shows too much mercy to the, right? If you just feed the horse all day, it won't be able to work, right? So he has his mercy to the body, to his animal, is actually cruelty to himself. Now it's interesting that the next pasuk, well, let's see, the Gra offers a few different pshatim. The next pasuk seems to make a relatively simple, self-evident statement. And it says, Oved at maso yispa lochem. He who cultivates his field will be satisfied with bread. Right? You work, you invest in your field, you will have sevia. Umaradei freikim, but if you pursue the empty ones, if you seek empty, meaningless things, chasar lev, you lack understanding. Now, the Grug has a few different pshat in here, but one pshat is, and it's an interesting switch of metaphor, and he doesn't develop it. That is, if in Pasuk Yud, the guf is called the behema, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, it's using the same idea with a different mashal, that the guf is the adama. We are, of course, our physical bodies come from the adama. And just as adama, on one hand, is dirt, but if you properly cultivate it, you have all sorts of good things coming out of the dirt. You could have wheat and fruit and everything else. Or you can have poisonous weeds. Right? What comes out of the ground is a function of what you put into the ground and how you cultivate it. So too, even though we are a form in Ha'adama, even though we are a form in Adama, but if we cultivate it properly, the guf itself can become a beautiful tool that helps us to achieve our avodas Hashem. We can only do mitzvahs through the guf. We can only learn Torah through the physical body, I mean the mind, but that's even the mind. The mind itself is part of the physical body and the like. And everything we accomplish to be zochet olam haba depends on what the guf does in olam hazeh. So according to that, it's the same metaphor, well, it's the same message, switching the metaphor. That in one pasuk, the body was described as the beast of burden. In the other pasuk, it is described as the raw soil out of which you get something productive and something beautiful. It's interesting that there's a pasuk in Amos. Amos is one of the Nevi'im. And Amos was really a Navi to the 10 tribes. So this is way before the Churban, one of the 10 tribes before the exile of the 10 tribes. And Amos, at the very end of the Sefer, this is actually the Haftarah for Yigash, and you'll see why. Amos says, it's a messianic prophecy, Hine yamim boim, days will be coming, v'nigash choresh bakotzer, that the plower will bump into the harvester. Now, what does that mean? It's always good to know what the pasuk would mean on a literal level. In a literal level, the pasuk is promising that the fertility of Eretz Yisrael will be so great that when it's time to plow the fields for the new planting, there'll still be people harvesting from the old crop. In other words, normally, when do you plow? We plow in Cheshvan, because that's the rainy season. Maybe that's when we begin to plow the field for the new planting. The Ketzira is around Shavuos time. So, Yamim Boim, days are coming where the harvest will be so huge that when it's time to plow the new crop, there'll still be a harvest going on. Right? That's the simple pshat. But the Medrash says that this is a remez. This is why it's the Haftarah of Vayigash. V'nigash choresh b'kotzer. Choresh is Yehuda, Yehuda is called a plower. Yosef is called the harvester. And they will approach one another. That's a remez by Yigash Eil of Yehuda. When Yehuda went to pray to argue with Yosef, that Binyamin shouldn't be imprisoned. Right? For Nigash Chorish B'Kaiser. And that's a remez that the Yosid Lavo, Yosef, who is the king of the ten Shvatim, the kings of the ten Shvatim came from Shevet Ephraim, shall be reunited with Yehuda. That's Mashiach Ben David. Right? That ultimate. Right? The Yigash Eil of Yehuda is the foreshadowing of the reunification of the ten tribes with the two tribes, the Achdus of Am Yisrael. But the question is, the Avnei Nezer says, why is it that Yosef is called the Kotzer? Why is Yosef called the harvester, and why is Yehuda called the Choresh? Okay, we understand, the Medrash identifies Yehuda is the Choresh, and Yosef is the Kotzer. So it's interesting, I guess, you know, the Avnei Nezer's most famous sefer is Egli Talon, Hilchos Shabbos. So one might expect, although he was a Gadol L'Chol HaTorah Kula, one might expect he would have a special affinity to think about things in Shabbos terms. So he says, okay, what is the halachic definition of the malacha of kotzer? Right? What is kotzer? So the halachic definition of kotzer is oker davor mi gidula. You uproot something from its source of nourishment and growth. That is why, for example, mushrooms, minatara, since they don't have roots and they're not getting nourishment directly from the soil, it is not kosher to gather mushrooms on a doraisa level. That's why you make a shakol on mushrooms. They're not borei pri ha'adama. So he says like this. He says that the human being is rooted in chaymer. We're rooted in soil in a very literal way. We come from the soil. Our bodies come from soil. Yosef represents an aspect of Avodas Hashem where you totally separate yourself from the Gashmias and the soil. When Yosef is confronted with sexual temptation with Potiphar's wife, Yosef just says no. So Yosef is the Avodas Hashem of Kaitzer. You separate yourself from the Chumrias, from the physicality, from the materialism, from the dirt. You totally separate. That's Yosef's Avoda. Just say no. He's Kovesh the Yetzer Lagamri. Now, Yehuda is Choresh. Now, what is Choresh? Choresh is when you take the soil and you soften it and you improve it, making it ra'oi to be able to produce something good. So he says Yehuda's Derech Avoda was different than Yosef. Yosef simply separated himself from temptation. Now, we know Yehuda. Yeah, we have to understand this. Yehuda was nichshel. Like when Yehuda is confronted with Tamar, and he thinks Tamar is a prostitute, Yehuda wasn't like Yosef that just said, can't do it. Rather, Yehuda was nichshel, and although it turned out to be a very good thing, and Yehuda, that was the mechanism of Yehuda doing tshuva, when Tamar said, right, his daughter-in-law that he didn't know he was with, said, I am pregnant by the man that gave me this money belt. And Yehuda would have, she would have gone into the Kivshan Aish had Yehuda not been Maida. But Yehuda was Maida, etc. So this is the idea where you take your chesronos and you take your weaknesses. But your weaknesses then become the stepping stone for your humility, for your submission to Hashem, for your koach of tshuva. And therefore, unlike Yosef, that is Oikir Tavar Megidulai, Yehuda represents the idea of even using the Averos, or the apparent Averos that you did, as the way that creates a Hiskarvus Lashem. And again, it's very interesting that ultimately Mashiach ben David, the ultimate redemption, comes via Yehuda, not through Yosef. And in fact, if you look at the whole Shalsheles, the whole development of the Messianic family, you see over and over again the appearance of apparent sin. We start off with Yehuda. Well, let's go a little further. On one level, we have Yehuda and Tamar, in which, as far as Yehuda is concerned, he's with a prostitute. Okay? Again, whether it was a technical avera, that's not so clear. I mean, Lav Dafka was an avera, but it certainly was not seemly or becoming. It was not covetic. It was something that was not the fima dregase. Now, Le'idach, to go back a little earlier, Rus, now this is another family, but Rus's family will eventually join with Boaz, and Malchus Beis David comes from that side. Rus, of course, we have Lot, had incest with his daughters, although he was drunk, and from that came Ammon and Moab. So Rus herself is a descendant of incest. When Rus encounters Boaz, right, Rus also comes in the middle of the night, and it looks like something that's not so proper. Right, so we have, then of course Shlomo HaMelech comes from, eventually David and Bathsheba. Right, so you have all sorts of improprieties, all sorts of sexual indiscretions that come. And the Gemara in Yuma says a very strange thing. The Gemara in Yuma says, nobody can become a person is not zocha to malchus unless there is a kupa shel shuratzim tuluya lo meyachrev. Now literally that means unless there's a basket of dead rodents. In English we would call it skeletons in his closet. That we want a melech that has all sorts of deficiencies in his body. We don't want somebody who's too perfect. That's the pshat. So again, there are different explanations here. One is that because a melech has so much power, a melech has to be humble. And therefore the melech has to come from origins that are humble. Another aspect is, a melech, a righteous melech, is a role model for us. And sometimes when someone is a tzaddik who never sins, that is not my role model. I sin. I make mistakes. A role model is someone who can make the mistakes that I make, but shows me how to do tshuva and how to grow. This was the old taina. This was Rav Huttner's famous taina years and years and years ago. But he didn't like the genre of gedolim biographies. Although some of them are better today. Because the gedolim biographies are just, when he was 4 years old, he did Bavli. When he was five, he did Yerushalmi. And he went through the Prima Gadim, 1,000 times. And by the time he was eight, he was offered to be Av Beis in the Vilna and everything else. And Rav Huttner says, those are great stories. And of course, a lot of times they're true. Not always, but they're often true. Remarkable, amazing achievements that we have no way of connecting to. But Rav Huttner said, that's the whole point. You have no way of connecting to him. You read about the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon's phenomenal, mastery of everything, and that's a wonderful story. Okay, what does it say to me? I'm not going to be that. So Rav Huttner actually said that we have to know, again, about the Gra, we don't know, but let's say the Chafetz Chaim and Gedolim that are a bit more recent. He said, Gedolim had struggles too. Gedolim had problems too. They had nisyonos. And Rav Huttner said, sometimes it would be very important to know about the failures and struggles that great people had and how they surmounted them. And then I could identify. Now, granted, halachically, that's a bit touchy because you do get into something called Lashon Hara. That's not so much as you're just allowed to, I know something your Chafetz Chaim did when he was 15, I'm going to tell you about it. It's not so much that you're allowed to do that. But Rav Huttner said, but that's what the Torah does generally. Of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides when it's the Toelas. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows us the mistakes and the pegamim and the averas. Now, yes, of course, the meaning of their averas is much, much different than us. It shouldn't be taken literally. But, so David and Bathsheba, right, was not adultery because there was a get, and then Uriah Achiti was chayav Misa because he was Morid B'malchus. All of that is true. But, people make a big mistake here. The Gemara's lashon is, anyone that says David sins is making a mistake. Okay. But I think we can legitimately say anyone that says that David didn't sin is also making a mistake, because it's very, very clear that the Pasuk is saying over and over and over again this was a tremendous avera. So even if technically it was not adultery, it was spiritually adultery. Even if Uriah Achiti was technically not murder because he was chayav Misa, what did Nasan HaNavi say? You killed him. You, David, killed him. Becherev b'nei Ammon. The sword of the Ammonite that killed him was your sword. So it's important not to go to the other extreme here. Chazal are making a very important point. Don't think that David HaMelech would commit a sin that would be equivalent to some guy in the street that goes around shooting people and raping people. Of course David didn't do that. But in Ruchnius, according to his Madrega, that's exactly what he did. In Ruchnius, with all of the technicalities and all of the Heterim, in Ruchnius, this is how HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges him, because this is what the Navi says. The Navi calls him a murderer. The Navi calls him one who took an Eish HaSish. So it's important to understand that as well. So Rav Huttner's point about Gedolim biographies is basically that when we learn from how a great person who falls, who fails, how they come back to Hashem, that's a message I can take. That's something I can learn. That you can try to become great, because in Aliyah there are going to be yiridos, ups and downs, and sometimes you go two steps forward and one step back, and sometimes you even go one step forward and two steps back. But you keep on going. And Rav Huttner quoted the pasuk in Tehillim, Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vekam. The tzaddik falls seven times and gets up again. And it doesn't mean that even though he falls, he gets up again. But it means precisely because he falls, he develops within himself kochos, of resilience. So there was, you know, I mentioned this before, there was Rav Nazan Kamenetsky, who's a Rosh Hashiva here in Yerushalayim, in Nitri, wrote a biography of his father, The Making of a Gadol. And this was not just a biography of Rav Yaakov, this really was a history of, I won't say the whole yeshiva movement, but really history of the last few decades of the early 20th century, before the Holocaust, of all the yeshivas, and of Slobodkin in particular, and it was about Rav Aaron and Rav Huttner, and all of these great people who were with Rav Yaakov together. And this was a book that talked about the nisyonos of Haskalah and secularism, and political Zionism and communism, and how even great B'nai Torah had these different struggles, or even things that might be a little more mundane or surprising, like, you know, writing letters to girls. Again, he tried to be very open about, of course, I have to say that whatever alleged lack of tzinius is portrayed in the book is, galaxies, universes removed away from what we talk about today. I mean, very, very innocent, very, very benign, but still a little off the beaten track in terms of what was going on. And this was a great, great book. It was a great, great book because you really got a sense of struggle. You know, you're not just born a gadol. No, there's struggle, and the gadolim go through a lot of the things that we go through, and if anything, maybe they go through them on a more intense level because they're greater, and therefore they, you know, even on the other things, you know, they have more passions. The Gemara says, "Kol gadol mechaveiro, yisro gadol menu." So this was a great, great book, really a classic book. But of course, it got put in chayyur, it got excommunicated. How can you write that Rav Aaron Kotler liked Dostoevsky? How can you write such a thing? Or that Rav Yaakov was reading books of history, whatever. How could that be? So the book got excommunicated, and again, so the author put out a revised edition, which got excommunicated again. So somebody put it on eBay, $500. And I remember now, and I wish, you can get the book for cheaper, but I remember the book came out, and it was like $25. I did not buy it at the time. Then, of course, this big controversy comes out, and everybody wants it, but of course, the book was not available for sale. Somebody put it on eBay for $500. Okay, I wasn't going to pay $500. But the truth of the matter is, it actually is available for free online. And Rav Nachman Kamenetsky himself, although initially, and again, if you have any questions, talk to him about it, because I can't really speak for him. I mean, because he's a Rosh Hashiva, and he's a person who has mevatel himself to Das Torah. Initially, his position was, if they put it in the chayrim, I will be mekabel it, I'm not going to sell it. He eventually concluded that there was so much misleading information that was being fed that he did not consider the chayrim to be binding at all. It was based on misunderstandings and distortions of other people who were feeding great rabbis this. So he actually does not follow it, and you can buy the sefer from him directly. Okay, be it as matter, I don't want to get into particular controversies. These are hard. But once again, though, this is a reiteration of Rav Huttner's fundamental points, that you can learn more from a person's failures, mistakes, and struggles, and how they come back from them. And as I say, there may be halakhas of Lashon Hara, but this is why sometimes you'll find that a Rosh Hashiva himself will talk about it. In other words, good. For me to say what I know about Rav Shach or somebody, that might be Lashon Hara, but a Rosh Hashiva might actually tell a bach, I want to tell you what I went through. And that's, if you ever had that experience, that is a tremendous, there's like nothing as meaningful to a person to hear that an Adam Gadol went through some of the same things that we go through and how they grow from it. Right? So good. So maybe I can't say it about somebody, but sometimes the Gadol himself will tell you about this. So bringing this in, because this is really what the Avnei Nezer says is Yehuda. You take the soil and you make the soil into a good thing. And that could be built into the Oved Ad Maso. That's what I was thinking of. That unlike Yosef, who represents the highest level of righteousness, who simply separates himself from the evil, Yehuda, from the mistakes themselves, develops a deeper relationship. That's Lirpuye Ara, softening the land, instead of simply saying, Kotzer, Oker, Dover, Megdula, and that's the meaning of Amos, Nigash, Choresh, Choresh, Bekaitzer, right? This is the Avnei Nezer, yeah.
Would Rabbi tell us, okay, follow, in your life, you should follow Yehuda's method, not Yosef, or maybe sometimes you do either one?
Well, listen, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to tell you, go out and sin. I mean, obviously, L'chatchila, we try to harvest. We try to be Yehudas. Yosef.
Yosef, okay.
Yosef is what you try to be. But realistically speaking, there are going to be times that you'll be successful because the harvest and the plowing, you know, occur simultaneously. Or that's also part of the remez, that they're simultaneous. A lot of times we're going to be nichshol. Now, the problem is this. If your model of avodah is Yosef, then when you actually are nichshol, you don't know what to do with that. Then you get broken. Then you get crestfallen. All you are is a failure vis-a-vis Yosef. So you have to know that there's an avoda of Yehuda. And it's Yehuda, which is the avoda of tshuva. You know, Yosef does not represent tshuva. Yosef represents the person who doesn't sin in the first place. Yehuda represents the person who falls. And therefore the whole kayach of tshuva comes from Yehuda. But it's also a philosophical answer, because it's not just the tshuva that from now on I won't sin, but it's a recognition that precisely from my averos I can develop a certain connection to Hashem. Rav Tzadok says, we say this every day in Pesukei Dezimra, it's from Tehillim, Lai bigvuras hasus yechpats v'lai b'sheike ha'ish yirtza reitza Hashem es yireyav. So let's look at that passage again. Lai bigvuras hasus yechpats. Hashem does not desire the strength of the horse. V'lai b'sheike yoyish yirtze. Nor does Hashem get pleasure in the thighs, that means the physical prowess of the man, the warrior. Who does Hashem get nachas from? Reitza Hashem es yireyav. Hashem gets desire from those who fear him, hamiyachalim l'chastei, who hope and yearn for his loving kindness. So it's a beautiful pasuk, but the pasuk is a little odd. Like, you know, what would Hashem want to the horse? You know, what exactly? He doesn't love the horse. Okay, I mean, what is that referring to? So Rav Tzadok says the following. Rav Tzadok says, the horse is a very powerful animal, and you know, horses were bred, I don't know, to be war horses. They would come into war, and you know, before there were tanks and the like. Even now, one of the most efficient ways, right? You're walking downtown Yerushalayim, suddenly see some gigantic horse. It's a way of riding into a crowd. You know, horses can be gentle, but they can be very fearsome animals as well. So, sus refers to a person who achieves. It's a person, really, not an animal. In other words, it's a remez to a person who conquers his Yetzirah by doing mitzvahs over and over and over again. Right? But it says, Hashem does not get perfect nachas in the one who is as strong as a horse in doing mitzvahs. Now, Shoke Ha'ish, Rav Tzedek says, is a remez to people who are kovesh the Yetzer, because the Shoke is around the sexual area, and that represents people who would have taivas to do Gilui Arayos, but they control themselves. So when it says, Hashem's greatest nachas, listen to Rav Tzedek touches up, Hashem's greatest nachas is not in those who by their strength of will can do mitzvahs constantly. And it's not those who have the power to hold themselves with the Yetzer Hara and not do any averas. Because as great as these people are, there is one flaw that it's hard to avoid. And that's the flaw of gaiva. That when a person is so righteous that they just don't sin, they could be misguided and they could think, kochi v'yotziyari, the same way in Gashmias you might think, it's my strength that does this. There's a kochi v'yotziyari yadi in Ruchnias too. So what does it say? Reitz Hashem Eshireyev, Hashem loves those who fear Him, ha'miyachalim l'chastai, who know that everything Hashem gives them is chesed, they don't deserve it. And Rav Tzedek says, the maila of the Baal Tshuva is the Baal Tshuva has humility. The Baal Tshuva knows he has made mistakes. The Baal Tshuva knows, and really all of us are Baal Tshuva. I don't mean the technical, modern use of Baal Tshuva, but you know, we know we make mistakes. When a person knows we make mistakes, then what you have is you have humility, and then you're makir the chesed of Hashem in all of your life. This is how Rav Tzedek interprets this, that there is an occupational hazard. The occupational hazard of being a tzaddik is that a tzaddik could have gaiva. A tzaddik could be proud of all that he's accomplished. But people who fail know how weak we are, how fallible we are, how vulnerable we are. And therefore we know that our success in life is Hashem's chesed, Hashem's loving kindness. It's not something that, you know, we can say we 100% deserve. So all of that is nichlal in what is called Oved Admasai. So I'm just adding this idea that it's not just take care of your physical body, which indeed is the same idea as the behemah. So why we would have two mishalim is not clear, but it may refer to a certain modality in which you connect to God precisely by being makir, your vulnerability and your weakness. And of course that can give you Abbas Hashem as well, because when a person knows how vulnerable they are, and yet how much love Hashem shows them, then their love for Hashem gets much, much increased, because they know that we don't deserve it. Right? What does the Sfasema say? I've said this many times already. Why are Jews called Yehudim? Right? They're very famous for it. Logically, we should not be called Yehudim, because Yehuda is only one tribe. Why are we called Yehudim? By the way, where is the first time that we're called Yehudim? It is very interesting. We're only called Yehudim after the Churban Bayis Rishon. The very first mention of Yehudim are in the book of Esther, where we're called Yehudim. This is during the 70 years of exile. And in the books of Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. These are the books of the Babylonian exile. Meaning, in the book of Malachim, for example, during the when we had a Beis HaMikdash, we are not called Yehudim, we're called Bnei Yisrael. That's what we're called. Although it is interesting, I have to admit, that the language of the Jews was called Yehudis. That's very interesting. In the book of Malachim, when Sancheiriv sent his army to destroy Yerushalayim, so Sancheiriv had an apostate Jew, Rav Shoka, who was like Tokyo Rose. Unless you read about this, is way before you were born, way before I was born as well. Tokyo Rose was a woman, I don't know if she was American or not, whatever it is, the Japanese got a woman who would broadcast on the radio to American soldiers in English, telling them that they have no chance of winning, surrender, and she would speak in perfect English so the Americans would for sure understand it. And her whole goal was to undermine combat morale. I think, it's amazing, I think she may have been executed after the war, I'm not sure. As a war criminal, it's very interesting that that would be a chi of misa mamish for that. But okay, but be it as it may, Rav Shaka was exactly the same thing. I don't know if the Japanese knew the Gemara. I know in Korea they learned Gemara. I don't know about Japan. And that is, Rav Shaka was a Yisrael mumer who went over to Sancheiriv's army, and his job was to speak to the Jewish people from the other side and tell them, surrender, 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 you have no chance, Sancheirif has crushed all of the other empires, etc. And at some point, Chizkiyahu HaMelech himself begged Rav Shaka. It's amazing, it's a very strange request. He begged Rav Shaka, please do not speak to the people in Yehudis, which meant Hebrew, it was Yehudis. Speak to them in some other language. Now, why would Rav Shaka agree to that? It's not at all clear, but you see that it could be that even as a Yid, he still had
some...
He was
a Rav?
Huh?
He was a Rav, that was his name, Rav Shaka.
No, he didn't have Smicha.
No, that was his name.
Yeah, it was one word, Rav Shaka. Rav Shaka. Yeah, Rav Shaka, one word, not Rav Shaka. Yeah. Anyway. That's
why did we wait until Esther to be told?
No. So I'm saying, so one simple answer might be, which is not the Sfasemis' answer, is that when all of Klal Yisrael was together, even if it was two different kingdoms, so we were B'nai Yisrael. But when the 10 tribes were exiled, and all you had was Yehuda and Binyamin, so Yehuda was by far the more dominant tribe, so we all became Yehuda. That would be a historical answer. But the Sfas Emes gives a different answer, which doesn't really explain why the shift occurred then, but just generally why we're called Yehudim. It says, Leah called her fourth son Yehuda. Why? Because she said, Hapam Oides Hashem. Now, I am grateful to God. Hoda'ah. I'm grateful. Rashi says, based on the Medrash, why did she say she was grateful then? What about the first thing? So Rashi says, she saw with Ruach HaKodesh that there would be 12 Shvatim. And she knows there are four mothers, Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah. So 12 divided by 4 are 3. So she is entitled, so she says, to 3. So you're not grateful when you get what you're entitled to get. You're just getting what you're entitled to get. You're not grateful to your boss to pay you your wages. You know, you earned it. But Rashi says, when she had number 4, Natalti Yeser al Chelki. I got more than my chelek. When you get more than your chelek, that is what we call gratitude. Right? That's Rashi. So says the Sfas Emes, this is the important lesson for us. Every Jew must go through life with the feeling, Hashem has given me more chesed than I deserve. And therefore, that is why we're called Yehudim. We have to have the attitude, Natalti, Yeser, Al Chelki. And of course, that gives a person simcha, because whatever Hashem gives you, you know it's more than you deserve. It's a good thing. And keep in mind, the Sfas Emes was writing not from 21st century relative affluence, but from 19th century extreme poverty and anti-Semitism in Poland, pre-Holocaust, but still... And the Sfas Emes says a person has to have the feeling, Natalti Yeser Al Chelki. And this is what Rav Tzedek is saying. Hashem does not get as much nachas in the mighty person who vanquishes the Yetzer Hara as he does in the person who feels everything Hashem gives him is the chesed of Hashem. Hamiyachalim, they yearn for Hashem's chesed. Okay? So that's Nichlal in Ove, that Maso, to be aware of our loneliness. Again, not in a negative sense. And again, Chas v'Shalom, this is not about being sad. It's the other way around. Being aware of our pachisus and then seeing what Hashem does for us gives a person simcha. We're not talking about being depressed here. It gives a person joy because they sense the loving kindness of Hashem that has no limit and no gavul. It's very important. The issue is not, as they say, to be subrachim, it's exactly the opposite. The idea is to be joyous with this idea. Natalti Yeser Al Chelki. Now, the Gra then brings another... this was a long arichas in which we essentially interpreted admaso as either your body, your physical needs, or admaso might be the materialism that drags you down, but you soften it and you use that as the springboard, kind of the Avnei Nezer. But the Gra then brings another upshot, and the Gra says a fascinating idea. Admaso refers to the very initial land that God gave mankind, which was Gan Eden. Right? Indeed. What was Hashem's mission to Adam HaRishon? Li'avda, to cultivate it, u'lashamra, and to guard it. And the Gra says that we still have that mission even today, but we just do it from a distance. Meaning to say, whenever we do mitzvahs, we are cultivating Gan Eden from a distance. What was that? It was actually Einstein's famous baptism. Nothing to do with this at all, but his criticism of quantum mechanics was he didn't believe in what he called spooky action at a distance. But this is spooky action at a distance, meaning to say, Adam HaRishon, of course, it's not clear exactly, even Adam HaRishon, what was he supposed to do? I mean, before the Chet, what was there to cultivate? It's not really clear. But be it as it may, he was given some mission in the physical garden. We don't have that, but the Vilna Gaon says, Obey that Masa. Every time you do mitzvahs, you are cultivating Gan Eden. You are actually building up your Gan Eden there, and therefore, that is the Oved Ad Masai Yochal Lechtia.
Is he referring to Olam Haba is Gan Eden?
Yes.
Each individual is...
Yes, at this point he's basically saying, again, I mean, in Kabbalah these are all different things, but he seems to be using it for Olam Haba, meaning you have a portion, which is your Gan Eden in Olam Haba, and everything you do in this world in a good way, you are Oved, you are farming your plot in Gan Eden, and therefore you will eventually get the bread of that plot, which is the reward that you'll get in Olam Haba.
This is a basic thing. Why is the term Gan Eden? If you imagine the next world, paradise, whatever, maybe it would be a palace. What's the garden? What is that?
That's a good question, and in fact, indeed, Chazal used many, many types of languages. We talk about palaces, we talk about chuppah, canopies, which are really kind of like small palaces. So all of those different explanations are given, but I think perhaps it's connected to the notion that unlike a building is static, meaning once a building is built, that's all it'll ever be. A garden keeps on generating, so this could be a remez that although in a sense, you cannot do more mitzvahs in Olam Haba, but we do say that the good that you did in this world, if it's much bigger, more and more people, does elevate you in Olam Haba. So perhaps we use the mushroom of garden to show that it's shaykh for a person to keep on growing, even in Olam Haba.
Rabbi, we're talking about wheat, a person, when he plants a wheat field, a person will get like maybe a ratio of 1 to 20 return on his labor.
I mean, 20 to 1, not 1
yeah,
to 20.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To 20 to 1. Right. Because he does a lot of labor, and it will get one stock, and that's what he'll get. If he does a tree, the return is 1 out of maybe, 300, because the tree will grow, it will get bigger, it will... increase the amount of fruits, and it could...
Well, it'll go on forever.
You don't have to work for many years. And so, is it more like a tree or more like a...
Well, a garden includes everything. Meaning, a garden is labdavka, an orchard. So it could be fruits, vegetables, grain, trees, all these different things.
For each labor, in that case, a person could, if it's a tree, in case of a tree, it's a much bigger return.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. But they say, I'm not sure, although again, obviously the Eitz Hadas, well, even then, the Eitz Hadas, we think it's a tree, right? But on the other hand, according to many opinions in Chazal, the Eitz Hadas might have been wheat, so there are views that say it was an esrog. I think nobody says it was an apple. I don't know where they got the apple. But there are shitas that say it was not a tree. We call wheat, an eitz. So the word eitz is an ambiguous term. It can include things other than trees. Okay. All right, so let's just see. Again, we're not going to do every pasuk, but just a few more pasukim here. And the next pasuk is interesting. Again, it shows the Gra's how much close attention the Gra pays to synonyms. That is, Chamad Rasha Mitzayid Ra'im. Chamad. The Rasha yearns or pines or desires. Mitzod. Now, Mitzod is like Mitsuda. Mitsuda means the tower, the fortress. The Rasha covets the fortress of the Ra'im. Now, Ra'im, I mean, the plural of Rasha is Rishaim. Now, Ra'im means evil people, but it is a deviation in form. I mean, the Rasha desires the fortress of the Ra'im. So what is the difference between a Rasha and a Ra? Ra can also mean a bad person. So the Gra says the following. The Gra says that Rasha is somebody who is nichshal in Bein Adam Lamakam. Bein Adam Lamakam. Doesn't keep Shabbos, doesn't daven, etc. And here, the Gra says a surprising statement. Derech HaRasha Shebein Adam Lamakam. It is the derech of a Rasha Bein Adam Lamakam Shetivay Hu Taif. He will tend to be a nice guy. Now, why that'll be so, perhaps that creates the Nisayan in the world, right? It's not a fair statement, but you'll hear the statement a lot. You know, I know this guy who doesn't, keep anything, and he's just the nicest guy, and then I go to from people, and they're so, whatever it is. Again, it's not fair because the HVH, but the Gra says, seems to tell us here, that it's the teva of people who are not careful in being Adam Lamakam, that they tend to have good natures, friendly natures, nice people,
humanist.
Whatever it is. Humanist, perhaps. Now, a Ra...
Was it not for humanist?
Well, okay. Yeah, it's interesting. Everyone knows the basic three denominations of Judaism today, Orthodox, Reformed, Conservative, but there is Reconstructionist, but there's even something... it's very hard to believe, but it's called humanism. Yeah, humanism. And they have synagogues. They don't believe in God at all. I mean, they don't believe in God. They have synagogues, and they have people who are called rabbi. Why do they call them rabbi? I don't get it. They call them rabbi. And I came across this. I went to a website. What does a secular? And they have a seder. And they talk about not Hashem, but they talk about freedom and this and that. It's an amazing thing, and they seem to be very nice people. They don't believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu at all. Okay. Be it as it may. So the Gra says that the difference.
Officially, they don't take a position on it. They say
that they have ancestors that were Jewish.
Oh yes, yes, oh. Yeah. They say that Jewish culture is important to them. The fact that Jews have won so many Nobel Prizes, whatever, this is important. Yeah.
That's okay. Racist.
Huh?
That's racist.
Yes, that's right. Okay. All right. Anyway, but the point is this. So, Russia is Ben Adam La Makam. Ra is Ben Adam La Chavera. As it says by Sodom, Anshe Sodom, Ra'im B'chataim. And we know that although Saddam had plenty of Ben Adam Lamakam too, they weren't good in, but the particular Averos in which Saddam was especially condemned was their cruelty, their lack of rachamim, and the like, right? Rayim v'chatoyim l'ashem me'ayit. So, the Gra gives you the following idea. The Gra tells you, don't make the mistake of thinking that the Ben Adam Lamakam people who rebel against God, their midos, are going to be such wonderful midos. Their midos will be good midos when things are going well. But ultimately, in the innermost recesses of their soul, they are going to be prepared to join the Ra'im when stresses get too much. Meaning to say, somebody can be, just like the Brisker Rav used to say, it's easy to have bitachon this was in 1920s. It's easy to have bitachon if you have $100,000 in the bank. Today would have to be more money than that. But okay. But what is bitachon when you don't have any money in the bank? That's bitachon. So here's the thing. It's easy to be a humanist when life is well, when you're making a good living, when you don't have stresses, when you don't have pressures. Sure, even though I don't believe in God, people ask the question, can you be a good moral person without believing in God? The answer is, under normal circumstances, absolutely. Because most people don't want to go around killing and raping and stealing. The average atheist, I mean, no one's going to tell you, oh, if you're an atheist, you know, you're going to go out and kill people. No, you're not. I mean, the average atheist is going to be a normal, good person. But, when there are really going to be stresses in his life in which it doesn't make sense to be moral. You're in Nazi Germany and you know where Jews are, and if you don't turn in the Jews, you can be killed. No, I can't say I have the exact numbers, but it's very difficult for an atheist to make a moral decision that will hurt him if he doesn't believe in God. In other words, if you believe in God, then you can make a decision no matter how much it's going to hurt you in the short run, because you have emunah that it's the right thing. You know, let me go back a little bit to digress. You know, Dostoevsky, one of the very famous line, he said, he put it in the mouths of Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment. He said, without God, all things are permitted. Meaning, nobody's going to say if you don't believe in God, you know, you're going to be a robber, a murderer, a rapist. Because normally, why should I be? I don't want to hurt people. But at any point at which your life will be in danger, the life of your family will be in danger, at that point, why should you be moral ultimately? What's the purpose of being moral if it's not in my self-interest? And therefore, the Gra is saying that ultimately, the person that's the Russia but seems to have a strong moral code will eventually disintegrate under stress to become a Ra, even in Bein Adam L'Makom. Now, Thomas Hobbes, famous British philosopher in the 1600s, I believe. And Thomas Hobbes, you know, England at the time, the Church of England, etc., And Thomas Hobbes, at some point, became a non-believer, which was a very dangerous thing. But Thomas Hobbes was pondering this question, what is the source of morality if you don't believe in God? Why be a moral person? I mean, if I want your car, I want your house, I want your wife, why shouldn't I just take what I want? Now, if you believe in Hashem, you have an answer. Of course. But if I don't believe in Hashem, why shouldn't I just take what I want? Why shouldn't I steal? Why shouldn't I just murder? So Hobbes was trying to ponder this, because Hobbes reached a place where he didn't believe in God anymore, but he wanted to be moral. So he was trying to figure out, he was kind of analyzing himself, like, why should I be moral if I don't believe in God? So what he came up with is the idea that ultimately, the non-theistic basis of morality, meaning the non-religious basis of morality, is based on selfish self-interest. And that is the following. I have to live in a world where I can't do whatever I want, because if I live in a world where I could do whatever I want, I also live in a world where you can do whatever you want. And I don't want you to do whatever you want, because then my life is not safe, and my property is not safe. So it's kind of, in fact, this is Hobbes' famous description, that life is nasty, brutish, and short. And it's only by people giving up the things they can do to other people that they will be given the security. I mean, you still have a criminal element, but you'll be given the security of other people giving up. Right?